Early wind southwest at 15, still overcast, 72 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're looking back at the Red Scare of the 1950s with the co-authors of a fascinating book called Witch Hunt, actually intended for young readers. In part two, out of the archives, you'll hear a brief conversation I was privileged to record with former New York Governor Mario Cuomo talking about our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. Here's part one. We are spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show looking at a fascinating and also very dark chapter in our nation's history. That period in the late 1940s and through much of the 1950s in which much of America was gripped in fear of a communist takeover. And Senator Joe McCarthy, of course, led the charge in rooting out communists living among us who were perhaps conspiring to bring down the United States as people knew it at that time, the so-called Red Scare. It is a period of our history that is important to understand and study, and a new book about this period goes about doing that in really intriguing fashion. The book is titled Witch Hunt, The Cold War, Joe McCarthy, and the Red Scare. I'm speaking today with the two co-authors of the book. Andrea Ballas is someone who has been part of the world of theater as a director and a playwright, has written young adult nonfiction and fiction alike, and taught for many, many years at the City University of New York. And has an abiding, burning interest in American history and has spoken extensively on various topics related to our country's history. The other author, Elizabeth Levy, has actually won awards for her fiction and nonfiction books for both children and young adults. And she has also brought a great deal of humor into much of the work that she has done. She is bringing her own unique voice to the proceedings for this new book published by Roaring Brook Press, again titled Witch Hunt, The Cold War, Joe McCarthy, and the Red Scare. Andrea Ballas, Elizabeth Levy, we welcome you both to the morning show.
Thank you.
I should mention that the two of you also co-wrote the book Bringing Down a President, The Watergate Scandal. And that is a book that maybe people should seek out in this anniversary year, that is the 50th anniversary year of President Nixon's resignation from office. But today we are focusing on your book, Witch Hunt. One of the things I want to ask both of you at the outset is what you remember directly from this period of time, to what extent you were around for these years of the so-called Red Scare, and what kind of personal impact those years and that period in our American history had on each of you personally.
This is Liz Levy. I'm a little older, so I remember being surprised. My parents never watched television during the day, and we had a tiny television, but they were watching the Army-McCarthy hearings. Also, like most many families, probably particularly Jewish families, we had someone who had worked in the State Department who was losing his job. It was never clear. Kids always hear what their parents are anxious about. We don't always understand it. But I remember them buying him a farm because he was not going to be able to work. And Andrea.
I'm a little bit younger, so I don't remember actually the McCarthy hearings or McCarthy himself. What I remember is what happened afterwards and the people who were damaged and the people who were whispered about and for years after the hearings that who were everyone knew and everyone stayed away from. So it was that collateral damage. It was the people who were damaged by the hearings. They weren't necessarily even called in, but their lives were ruined.
So this book is, although I think would be of interest to just about anybody who is interested in knowing more about this period of our history, is at least primarily intended for younger readers, although by no means would we call this a children's book. And of course, its subject matter is tremendously serious. Tell us what prompted you to want to write a book for young readers about this period in our history. Were there particular things about the so-called Red Scare that you think the average young person in America needs to know about?
I think it was really important to know that history happens to you and it happened to your parents. And so we talked to so many people who, when they were the kids who were reading our book's age, their parents lost their job. They remember that fear. I've always believed that kids know and understand a lot, but they want to understand a little more. And those stories really help us, like the person who thought when her mother was called to the Un-American Committee house that she was going to go into a house where she went in as an American and came out something else. So those are the things that I want kids to know, that history is happening to them.
This is Andrea. Mm-hmm. I am taught for many years a global history and an American history introductory course on various campuses of the City University of New York. And I was aware, became astonishingly aware of how little 20th century history is being taught and how little my students knew about the history of the last 100 years, which affects them, which deeply affects them.
So explain to our listeners sort of what went through your minds in actually assembling this book and sort of the format by which you have tackled this this topic. I do want to quote one thing in your author's note and have you expand on it, and that's when you say, "We wanted to tell the story of Joseph McCarthy and the Red Scare through the words of the people directly involved." Tell us more about that facet of your book and other ways in which you have carefully shaped this book to effectively connect with potential young readers.
Well, part of the reason for doing it this way, I think actually it is because we started in the theater. That's what our origins were. That's where we met 30-something years ago. We met working in a theater company, and that's where we started. And for me, those plays were about history. The voices of people in the past, the actual words that people said, which are so astonishing sometimes. I mean, they said the quiet part out loud so often that finding those words was just a great discovery, and it populated the history with humans, and actually history has humans.
And you're from Wisconsin, where McCarthy is from, and I think it's really, I wanted kids to remember, he was came in with Nixon and John Kennedy, but he was much more popular. He wasn't a villain. He was friendly to everyone when he came into the Senate. We found this wonderful Saturday Evening Post article that was just when he was a young senator. He's a muscular six-footer with long arms and square, capable hands. He encouraged guards and elevator operators to call him Joe. To woo the women correspondents, he invited eight from the Senate press gallery to a fried chicken dinner, and he cooked the dinner himself. Those are fun details, and they're history. You know, that's the contemporary 1954 history.
And it's a reminder that McCarthy is also a person.
Yeah.
And if you're going to look at him, if you really want to look at what happened, you have to look at that part of him. You have to look at all the parts of him, or you're too much imposing your vision. We tried really hard to make it possible for our readers to come to their own conclusions, to provide information, the actual primary source information, but always with the reminder that the primary sources, the quotes of the people, that they lie, that they do say the quiet part out loud.
Even for a book for kids, we have 360 footnotes, but we do remind kids that even if it's footnoted, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
Right. You have these sections throughout the book in which we read the words, fly on the wall. Explain this interesting facet to the book and the way that you have structured it.
Thank you. That was one of our favorite moments when, because it's true, Andrea was in the theater. I, in the 70s, came to her company. I was doing all sorts of different writing. Never have I found something to make less money than to even children's books, but I had a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
But when we were talking about working again, we really came up, we don't remember who, but with the "you always want to be a fly on the wall." And then we knew we could write this as plays. Kids think of it as Twitter, but the Landry will tell you what the fly helps us do.
The fly is a narrator who can help us through the tough times that our background, that our context. The fly can fill in some of the things that you need to know in order to understand the words of the people if they actually say them.
And he can make jokes. Andrea is very funny herself, mind you. She always wants to put the fly jokes in.
Very good.
Oh, yeah, the fly is a delight.
We're speaking with Andrea Ballas and Elizabeth Levy about the book they have co-written called Witch Hunt, The Cold War, Joe McCarthy, and the Red Scare. I do appreciate that... that your book, this is not a huge book. It is not a sprawling, lengthy examination of this period. And yet you cover a remarkable amount of ground. And you also, I think, are wise to begin before the literal onset of the so-called Red Scare. You help the reader understand sort of how the backdrop against which this all began to unfold, namely the Great Depression and the way in which communism offered a certain sort of possibility that was actually very appealing to many Americans. And I think a lot of people, when they look back at the Red Scare, really want to just kind of focus on the unjust accusations of people unjustly accused of being communist, when in fact there were plenty of Americans in that period who actually found themselves drawn to at least certain communist principles and maybe even went so far as to join the Communist Party. I think it's helpful, especially to young readers, to understand how and why such a thing was possible.
We worked very hard on trying to provide the context for people. We understood that part of the problem with reading history is you start in the middle of the story and you don't know what came before and you don't have any sense of what might come afterwards. So we tried to provide, and the fly, of course, was a great help here, to provide that context that you would need.
And the people we interviewed talked about that their father was a communist in the 1930s. It was because he felt that life was unfair and also was a place to go to meet girls. And that all of that is a mix in history. And Robert Oppenheimer, because of the movies, you know, we do start with the bomb also. But he wrote in the 30s, I saw what the Depression was doing to my students and began to understand that deeply political and economic events could affect lives. And I began to see the need to participate more fully in the life of the community. He didn't want to be a necessarily a communist, but he wanted to both help his students and people poorer than he was.
I'm glad that you made mention of the fact that we're not only talking about the Depression and the widespread suffering of so many Americans that kind of gave rise to interest in communism and other alternative forms of government, if you will, but that also one of the precursors to the Red Scare was the development of the atomic bomb and the fact that we were suddenly living in a world in which we not only possessed this weapon capable of overwhelming destruction, but before long, the Soviet Union possessed that very same technology. And honestly, I don't think I'd ever stop to think until I read your book about how that factor also very much ratcheted up the overall anxiety of so many Americans, which really helps us understand how the Red Scare could take hold as dramatically as it did.
The Red Scare also was it was sort of easy to understand. It was us and it was them. And it was a way of organizing the political forces in a world that was rapidly changing. And we try to make that clear, that the world was changing for Americans as well as the globe in a complete sense. And that this is how politics was organized for many years. This is a thing that our students didn't quite understand, was that this axis of evil, this tension between the East and the West, was a shaping influence for the second half of the 20th century.
And also that there's never any easy answers. There's a wonderful professor, John Jay, who had studied the atom bomb. And the truth is, Russia had great scientists. They were going to be able to build the bomb. And it's so easy to see things in red and black, you know, but that's really usually not the way history works. And we wanted kids to understand that even people who aren't, you don't have to be evil to have bad consequences.
And the idea that the world was being ruined because Russian spies had stolen the secrets of the atomic bomb is actually a pretty big exaggeration, because Russia had a lot of the scientific information already and was already very close. So it wasn't so much an attack directly. It was a widening of the war, essentially.
I also appreciate the fact that you are willing to take the time to tie in the matter of civil rights. And of course, this is one of those cases in which there is another issue that does not at a glance appear to have any direct connection to the Red Scare. And yet it was something that ultimately, in a sense, fed some of the fears that were at the heart of the Red Scare. And I think you do a great job of kind of laying that out for us. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, more, we didn't do that. That's really what history did.
But I mean, you took the time to talk about that. But you took the time to talk about it, which I appreciate.
Young black soldiers came back from World War II feeling they had fought racism in Germany and fought for freedom, and that therefore they would be treated better here. And when they weren't, they organized to do it. And as soon as they organized, they were accused of being led by the communists. And even much later, Muhammad Ali, the famous boxer who was drafted, said he could see no reason why he should be sent off to kill people, brown people, in another country when African Americans were suffering so much at home. And it's woven through the whole story. But unsurprisingly, people don't pay attention to that thread that runs through the story.
And we do have to say, though, we try to make him not a total villain, but J. Edgar Hoover particularly, who was from Washington, D.C., and actually had been a librarian. I was always proud of that. That was one of my favorite facts. But he was totally convinced that the civil rights movement was back, only came to be because of the communist influence. And he kept on that long after Joe McCarthy, who did much less harm. We want to remind people that often the harm was done by people trying to control Joe McCarthy. But people make mistakes. And both Eisenhower and Truman, by forcing loyalty oaths on every teacher and everyone, and particularly on gay people in the State Department, that harm wasn't Joe McCarthy's all, you know, doing.
Even if people didn't personally feel the effects of McCarthyism, they did feel it. They felt it in what they were allowed to see and read and the people with whom they were allowed to associate. So everyone was affected by it.
We should let you ask questions. You can see how our writing goes.
But no, this is great. I'm enjoying this very, very much. And I think you're pointing out something that at other points in our history, maybe we have also experienced, but maybe it's never been so potently experienced as it was during the so-called Red Scare, namely how frightening it was to just say something out loud. And if one, for instance, would express anything that even remotely had the whiff of being even just interested in communist ideas or socialist ideas, that would be enough to brand you as a card-carrying communist, and with very, very dire consequences. I mean, it's probably important for us to remember a time when so many Americans were frightened of even asking certain questions.
But you have to remember also how many people taught their children not to be frightened. One of our favorites was somebody in urine radio and media. His parents were one of the first television people. His mother was one of the first women in television, and they were afraid of being blacklisted. They bought a farm in Connecticut and started raising chickens. And when the FBI came to visit, the person we interviewed said he was scared. And my dad said, don't worry, communist chickens don't make headlines, and that's what they're looking for. So there are many adult people in this book who were taught by their parents not to be afraid. And there were kids right near you in Indiana, Andrea's favorite. I'll let her take it.
Oh, that is my favorite. You know, I know we're not letting you ask questions, but when we started this book, one of the things we were interested in was book banning. And I started looking at what books were banned, and I discovered that Robin Hood was banned.
Because he stole from the rich and gave to the poor, and that was the communist line. That was an actual quote.
Yeah. So the students in Indiana decided that they would like to honor Robin Hood, and they went to a chicken farm, and they collected a lot of chicken feathers, which you can do because they're very light. You can stuff them in a bag, and they dyed them green, and then they threw them off the balcony of the state legislature as a protest against banning Robin Hood, because after all, Robin Hood was their hero.
And the FBI did come, and they were very scared, but they were still proud they did it. And there still is a Green Feather Society.
Amazing. Amazing. Something that you said, and I don't even remember just what, reminds me of the interesting story. There are so many interesting stories in this book about the entertainer Harry Belafonte. And he was somebody who, like other Black Americans, came out of the service with certain great expectations. And you quote him saying, I came out of the service with great expectations that we had just defeated fascism. We had just defeated totalitarianism. We had just defeated the philosophy of white supremacy. I had expected America would have been open and generous and rewarding to its Black citizens who had served in the war and served with great honor. And of course, in many cases, just the opposite proved to be the case. I want to have you tell the story of Harry Belafonte as he began to speak up, and the way in which he ended up on the so-called enemies list, and what occurred with that very popular television program, The Ed Sullivan Show, and Mr. Belafonte.
Yes. Well, Belafonte is one of my heroes, but he was going to appear on The Ed Sullivan Show, and they canceled him. But his agent said, "You're on a list." And he, what list? He said, "They don't know, but we have a list." And but then he got a call to tell me that I could go to rehearsals. And the fact this for that act took me off the blacklist. You never knew why he was allowed on the Ed Sullivan Show, but suddenly, and this is the confusion of history, suddenly his friends suspected that maybe he had named names. He never did. He stayed, you know. But the very fact that he got to be on the Ed Sullivan Show meant that his friends suspected him. That's why history is weird. And he says, "I hadn't played the betrayal game, and it was a very, very difficult time for me."
I think we should explain that that was the pressure that people who were called into the House Un-American Activities Committee were asked to name their friends and associates. So they were asked to shift the blame. They were asked to name others. And that's how the Red Scare is spread.
And, of course, I think your book does a marvelous job of explaining the way in which those who were trying to root out communists and communism from America turned their attention to Hollywood. You talk at one point about how those who were leading the charge needed a headline, and what better place to look for one than at the movies. Tell us more about why Hollywood was such an inviting target, and how ultimately, and at least to some extent, it backfired.
It was an inviting target because it was bright and shiny, and people were really interested in it. And it was a way to attract attention,
and you could get famous people to testify. Actually, on both sides, Walt Disney, a lot of it was based on fear of unions in Hollywood, that the writers and actors were forming unions, and unions were often considered communist. And so they attacked people who had been writers, head of the Writers Guild. We all lived through a recent actor strike. But there was also pride, like in Harry Belafonte, we talked to children of actors like Jack Gilford, who was on the Charmin commercials, and his parents, they all were very proud that they never named names.
The naming of names became the dirt of the McCarthy period, because you were asking to rat on your neighbors, and people did, and it created unfriendly neighborhoods.
And as far as doing research, one of the joys is finding something you don't expect. One of the Hollywood 10, Ring Lardner Jr., who had to go to prison because he wouldn't name names during the hearings about Hollywood, when he got out, he couldn't get any work writing in Hollywood because he was blacklisted. But he got work in England, ironically, writing a new Robin Hood series,
as did many blacklisted writers.
So we found, Andrea found all the scripts, and we sprinkled them through the book. That was one of our great joys of doing research, of finding something you don't expect.
Absolutely. And, of course, it's important to say also that many of these folks from Hollywood, when they would take the stand, not all, but many of them were incredibly effective. That is, in undermining the line of questions that were being posed to them. I mean, they were effective. They were in some of them. Many of them were really fearless on the stand. But many of them, including some of those first writers, paid a dear price by actually being sent to prison. So
they did pay a price, but they sure were funny as they were testifying. It's proof that it's not a good idea to get a bunch of writers on the witness
stand. We had the fly say that, but you're probably finding that it's not the best idea. You're not going to easily intimidate writers.
Absolutely. One of the things you point out in your book at a couple of different points is the uncomfortable position in which then-President Harry S. Truman found himself. And the way in which he was trying to navigate this very tricky political situation. At one point, you say something quite frankly that I think might be worth expanding on for a moment. When you write, this is at a point when all of these lists were being circulated, lists calling into question the loyalty of various Americans. And you write, Truman was fooling himself. He fooled himself into thinking that he could hunt communists in the government and at the same time protect American liberties. In other words, President Truman was, in a sense, trying to accomplish two things at the same time that were, in a sense, at their heart, contradictory.
I think that that's a contradiction of the Cold War also. Truman was a participant, was a Cold War warrior and was scared of communists. He was also a person who talked to people and knew that a lot of the accusations were ridiculous, that they were in fact just distractions. And he was caught between them, as so many political leaders are, about how he could thread that needle.
And I think we felt that way about Eisenhower, too, who really did not like Joe McCarthy, wanted to rein him in, but because also the president has more power, his loyalty oaths probably lost more people their jobs, particularly in the Lavender Scare, which came under Eisenhower, where people were told that they could not work if they were known to be gay, including a woman who would have been the first gay admiral, and she was afraid to take the job because she felt that she might be outed. So we want kids and ourselves to understand history is complicated and heroes make bad decisions sometimes, not because they're evil. You know, we all do. It's easy to do, look back and say, oh, I wouldn't have done that. I don't know, you know, if I had power, what I would have done. But I think that's really important when you read history to understand
ambivalence.
Yes, thank you.
For sure. We do, of course, meet a number of heroes, and let's say heroes and heroines in your book. That is, people who had the courage and the wisdom to stand up to Senator Joe McCarthy. And one of them, an extraordinary woman by the name of Margaret Chase Smith,
Yay. A
Republican from the state of Maine. Tell our listeners more about her particular story, and why you give it such prominence in your book, Witch Hunt.
Well, she was one of the first female senators, and spoke for Maine with Maine's courageousness and doggedness. And she was an opponent of McCarthy, but more than that, she was a proponent of free speech and free expression and the liberties on which the United States was based. And she saw what McCarthy was doing as a direct attack on those liberties and those freedoms. And she tried to censor him in the Senate of the United States really unsuccessfully.
And there were many. One of them, the first, Milo Radovich, I know you're from the Midwest. He was an Air Force reservist. He was the son of a Serbian immigrant. And they wanted him to resign because his father read Serbian newspapers, and his mother played Paul Robeson records, and Paul Robeson was a wonderful singer who was considered a communist, and he refused. And Edward Murrow did the first See It Now television show that really attacked the Red Scare about Milo Radovich. So there's many heroes, some are known, but also so many people whose parents they felt were heroes who we talked to.
But I want to go back to Margaret Chase Smith because she was really made fun of, and yeah, McCarthy just sort of blew her off and said, it's how nice that the girls make speeches. And in fact, the newspapers called her Margaret Smith and her seven dwarfs because that's all the support that she could get in the Senate. So I just had to stick that in because she was able to hang in there despite McCarthy making fun of her.
Right. And I want to actually take a moment to read the statement that she made, in which she spoke so forcefully and eloquently against Senator Joe McCarthy. These are the words of Margaret Chase Smith. "I would like to speak briefly and simply about a serious national condition. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States Senator. I speak as an American. Those of us who shout the loudest about Americanism in making character assassinations are all too frequently those who, by our own words and acts, ignore some of the basic principles of Americanism. The right to criticize, the right to hold unpopular beliefs, the right to protest, the right of independent thought. The exercise of these rights should not cost one single American citizen his reputation or livelihood." I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying it any better than that. And
it's really cool. Thank you. You move both of us to tears hearing that, someone else reading that, and your voice saying that. Thank you.
So ultimately, the balance of your book, of course, goes much further in exploring other facets of this story, including the story that some will know about even Lucille Ball of I Love Lucy fame being drawn into the web of this so-called Red Scare. In a nutshell, what do you think ultimately led to Senator Joe McCarthy's downfall? How did all of this ultimately fall apart?
The institutions held. There was a recognition that free speech and free reading and free expression were indeed worth salvaging and worth saving.
I have a slightly different point of view because I really think things in history often happen for accidents. And when Roy Cohn, who worked for McCarthy, had a good friend who was drafted, he wanted to keep him out of the army. And suddenly, you know, Americans don't want their sons. They're going to have to peel potato. They don't want a rich man's guy not to peel potato. And he started pressuring Eisenhower's administration to let his friend David Schein out of the army. And as a kid, I didn't realize the McCarthy Army hearings weren't about communism. They were about trying to get David Schein out of the army. So McCarthy fell after that. He was censured. He did the famous speech where the other lawyer said, "Have you no decency?" But the truth is, Hoover didn't fall. The Red Scare somewhat went on, and people had to continue being brave long after McCarthy left.
And for McCarthy, it's hubris.
And so accidents happen in history. But people who believe, like you just read about Margaret Smith, we have to keep doing it again and again and again.
Hmm. Yes, and of course we find certain issues, certain fears, once again rearing their head, even in 2024 America. And so there is much to take away from your book, and not only young readers, but old readers as well, I think, have a lot that they can learn from your really wonderfully written book. Again, titled Witch Hunt, The Cold War, Joe McCarthy, and the Red Scare, published by Roaring Brook Press. The co-authors, Andrea Ballas and Elizabeth Levy. I thank you both for giving the world this really interesting book, and I thank you for being my guests on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's program with an interview from the Morning Show archives that I recorded 20 years ago with the late Mario Cuomo, former governor of the state of New York. We take a very interesting and perceptive look at our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, today with Mario Cuomo, former governor of the state of New York, author of several books, an attorney, and the author of a new book called Why Lincoln Matters, Today More Than Ever, published by Harcourt, in which Mr. Cuomo takes a look at Abraham Lincoln's great legacy and examines how it is a very pertinent, important legacy for us in 2004. Mario Cuomo, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the things you say is that Abraham Lincoln, I suppose like many figures, but maybe exceptionally so, is someone complex enough that we cannot quickly or easily label him. You say there is no political label elastic enough to fit around his magnificent complexity. Briefly explain what makes Lincoln such a complex figure.
Well, you have to remember the Founding Fathers started by saying we don't need and shouldn't have political parties. So all these labels that come from political parties, liberal, conservative, Whig, whatever, Founding Fathers thought you shouldn't do that. You should be ad hoc. You should take each issue and decide the issue on its merits, and wherever that leaves you, that will identify you by the conclusions you arrived at instead of these projected, you know, broad-based ideologies. And so you wind up with Lincoln, who was called by James G. Randall, a great Lincoln scholar in the early part of the 20th century, the liberal statesman. David Donald, in his more recent biography, much acclaimed, this reminds us that Lincoln liked thinking of himself as liberal, but liberal meant something else in those years. So no label that we use today. And look, how good can the labels be? Conservative, is it a good label? If it were, why would you have to add a muck-up mitigator word like compassionate? Democrat, is it a good label? If it were, why would you have to add new Democrat? What's the difference between it? And so on and so forth. So, yeah, he's too complex to be labeled. Both Democrats and Republicans, whether it was Bill Clinton or the first George Bush or the second, are Lincoln fans. Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt. Traditionally, the most popular president in the United States among historians and most people is Lincoln.
One of the problems with that, of course, is that it is a tempting thing to, in a sense, misappropriate Lincoln's name.
Absolutely.
You tell this amazing story from 1992 when Ronald Reagan misquotes Abraham Lincoln or attributes to Lincoln several quotes which, in fact, he did not make, only a writer many, many years later interpreting Lincoln. I suppose when we deal with a figure as distant from us as Lincoln is, there is that temptation and something we have to be careful about.
Oh, sure. And you'll find Republicans regularly criticizing my book, especially very conservatives. And most of the time when I read their criticisms, it's obvious they didn't read the book. What they note immediately is that a lot of Lincoln's positions, although by no means all of them, are positions that I share. But that's not because I have twisted Lincoln into my views. It's because he influenced me. I have been reading Lincoln since long before I was a politician. My sister gave me the collected works, which had been published by Basler in 1955 for the first time, all of Lincoln's writings in 9 volumes. And I've been reading them ever since. And so to a large extent, I have been influenced by Lincoln, not mesmerized by him. I think he was wrong when he suspended the writ of habeas corpus. I think he was wrong in what he did to the Constitution in the Civil War. I think he was wrong in the way he selected Supreme Court justices, which was on the basis of politics instead of on the basis of whether they would be really good judges. Roosevelt did the same thing wrong. And so there are things about Lincoln that I didn't approve of, but overall, his wisdom was such, his intelligence, his subtlety, his handling of complexity, his ability to articulate everything in terms that the most brilliant people could understand and the people who were uneducated could understand. Those are the gifts that make him so valuable today.
You talk about how Lincoln is the president we look to for affirmation more than any other, and you cite as the most important reason his incredible wisdom. And we get a sense from your book that at least part of where that wisdom came from were those incredibly humble roots from which he sprang.
You know, there's no denying that the more life experience you have, the more wise you're going to be, because the world is made up of all sorts of variegated and diverse components, brilliant people, people who are not gifted with even normal intelligence, and everything in between. And economically, our systems have been so inefficient that we produced all kinds of terrible differences. We are now, in the United States of America, richer than we've ever been, at the top. We have more billionaires, more millionaires, literally, than ever before. More people over $100,000 a year than ever before. But we also have more poor people than we had 7 years ago, and a middle class that's sliding downward with an average wage that's going down. And only one out of four or five of our workers are high-skilled. Imagine that. Only 20 or 25% of our workers are high-skilled in a world that demands high-skill workers. So, it's a complicated world. There are a lot of differences. There are a lot of things we should be doing we're not doing. And Lincoln reminds us of all of that.
Hmm. One of the points you bring up is that we face divisions in our country at the moment that are severely delineated. And you've touched on class. Race is another issue which divides us in some surprising ways. And you think we can look to Lincoln for some wisdom here as well?
Well, yeah, Lincoln would be disappointed. I mean, Lincoln, of course, the two great accomplishments in terms of politics, well, I think probably you'd have to say, were keeping the Union together, and the other was beginning the process that ended slavery and that he hoped would end most of the discrimination. And so we had the amendment, 13th Amendment, which he started, and then, of course, he was martyred, and we lost him. But then, having adopted the 13th Amendment, we didn't do anything real about it for 100 years. It wasn't until 1954 that you had, you got rid of segregation in the schools. You didn't have a civil rights law until 1965. We're still struggling over affirmative action and how to deal with race. And so, I think Lincoln, who, incidentally, there is a good deal of criticism of Lincoln by Laron Bennett, an African-American historian, and others who say that Lincoln was not as good on race in his early years as he should have been. And he said things like, look, I don't believe they should be slaves. That's wrong. Slavery is wrong. On the other hand, I wouldn't marry one. And I don't think they are our equal in all ways. He changed his mind, and so did Douglas change his mind about him. And that's Frederick Douglass, not Stephen. Right. Frederick Douglass, the great black leader, said early in his relationship with Lincoln, this man's the white man's president. He wound up saying he was a man who helped save the blacks in this country. So Lincoln grew over the years, which is another important thing about great people. They don't settle for their gifts. They build on their gifts, and they get smarter and better and more useful. Lincoln did during the course of his life.
The book, again, is called Why Lincoln Matters Today More Than Ever. It ends with a remarkable chapter in which Mario Cuomo imagines what Abraham Lincoln might have to say to Congress in the year 2004. The book is published by Harcourt Incorporated. Mario Cuomo, I really enjoyed this book. I found it fascinating, and I thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
The preceding interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2004. Mario Cuomo passed away in 2015 at the age of 82. His other books include Reason to Believe, Forest Hills Diary, and The New York Idea, An Experiment in Democracy. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Barbara Bratton, who is the outgoing director of the Kenosha Public Library. We will be talking about the place of libraries in the 21st century. and about her career with the Kenosha Public Library. I hope that you can join us. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We'll have cloudy skies this morning. A little more rain is possible, but by the afternoon, we should see sunny skies. We're headed for a high of 79 degrees. Overnight, a 40% chance of more rain with a low of 58. Tomorrow should be sunny with a high of 71 degrees, breezy conditions, and sunshine is expected then all the way through next Tuesday. So something for which to be very, very grateful. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva,